Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Milkshakes Markets Madness. My name is John Kutzmita. I'm joined always every week and every time we record with Brent Johnson, the man behind the dollar milkshake theory. Brent has been saying for some time that this part of the year, after you come out of the summer doldrums, tend to be a little more exciting, a little more volatile, and they certainly have, particularly this last week, which we're going to get into. Now, if you're new to the show, we encourage you to visit the Start Here playlist on the top of our YouTube channel. It'll kind of take you down that dollar milkshake rabbit hole so you understand our views and global macro themes that we discuss here on the show. But Brent, let's talk about this past week because, you know, it's been slowly getting more and more interesting, as you like to always say, as the summer has kind of ended. But this week in particular was extremely volatile as asset prices from everywhere you looked, from the dollar to stocks to bonds, were up and down and all over the place. If we took perhaps Fridays or, you know, Wednesday through Friday last week was very interesting. So if we take that as a starting point to where we're ending the week today, it's been quite a wild ride.
Yeah. And, you know, and like you said, you know, we've been talking about, you know, kind of all year that the Q3 and Q4 could get a little bit volatile. And that's exactly what's happening. You know, what I thought of this week is if again, for people who are new, you know, all of our past episodes are online for people to view. For people who tune in every week, you might remember a couple weeks ago before the Fed meeting, you know, we were anticipating, you know, what was going to happen that week. And at that time, it was October 30th or 29th or something like that. And we said that equities were very oversold, and that it's possible that whatever the Fed said on the following Wednesday would be taken as dovish, and that the market might bounce for a few weeks. But but I also said I didn't think that was necessarily going to be the all clear. It wasn't necessarily a great buying opportunity for the long term, although it could be a good buying opportunity for the short term. And lo and behold, this is exactly what's happened. We've had another extremely hard bounce coming out of the Fed meeting a week ago. On last week's episode, you know, I talked about how, you know, the bounce was pretty hard already, but that I thought that the market was getting a little bit ahead of itself with regard to what Powell said. And I thought that in the course of time, you know, it would be known that Powell actually meant to be more dovish than he came across in the meeting, in the Fed meeting or in the Fed press conference. And sure enough, you know, later in this week, I guess it was it yesterday or Wednesday, he held did a speech and he came across as pretty hawkish again. So kind of walked back some of that dovish outcome of the Fed meeting, and markets sold off a little bit subsequent to that speech. But then today they were up big again. So we've kind of gotten that 2-week bounce coming out of the Fed meeting. You know, I'm anticipating perhaps a little bit of follow through early next week, maybe Monday, Tuesday. But I personally would, and over that same time period, the VIX has gone from 24 to 14. I mean, it's incredible, right? Even though all the stuff we've got going on in the world, the VIX just keeps getting crushed, you know, week after week, or not week after week, but, you know, every time we get to one of these rallies, the VIX comes down. And I think the opportunity to buy put protection with equities screaming higher and the VIX below 15 is an opportunity that shouldn't be ignored. Now, I'm not saying that you need to sell everything and go put all your money into puts, but I will often hedge our positions with puts, and I like to do it when the VIX is low, and that's what we have. And so I will probably be adding to some hedges on Monday or Tuesday if we get further follow through from here.
So if anyone is not familiar with the term dove or hawk or dovish or hawkish, we did an episode, and I'll highlight it here, called When Doves Cry, where we actually talk about what those terms mean. Now, I might have misheard you. I knew what you were meaning to say, and maybe that's actually what you said. And like I said, just misheard you. But Powell was misinterpreted of potentially being too dovish or too, you know, bond-friendly, market-friendly last week as post the FOMC rate decision to pause, markets rallied. And you had said that you expected subsequent to that to be a more hawkish tone from the Fed, particularly Powell, to kind of take away those animal spirits, hawkish being a little more tighter on the monetary policy side, not as accommodative. And the animal spirits concept is that, you know, we're very irrational beings, and sometimes we'll interpret things more excitedly than they're intended to be, and markets will be, you know, off and running on their own without any kind of real connection, or perhaps a complete disattachment, or a disattachment from fundamentals. So you mentioned Powell. He had this tone that was misinterpreted after the FOMC. Markets kind of rallied a bit. You expected a bit of a pullback, or at least you expected the markets, the Fed to try to tame that a bit. This week he came out, did just that. Now, also during the week, though, we had a number of Fed speakers, and the messaging was all over the place. Like, some were dovish, some were hawkish. Some of the things I just want to point out real briefly, because I think there's some funny comments we'll get to highlight at another time in the future. Fed banker Goolsbee made the comment that the Fed can continue down what he calls the golden path to a soft landing. And then Waller made the comment that everything was booming in Q3. 10-year yields were tightening, has been a monetary policy earthquake. Now, speaking of 10-year yields, I think just bond yields in general, especially this week when we come to volatility, we had a big rally post FOMC meeting last week when the Fed paused. That carried through all week to Friday. Then this week, it was a little bit of up and down. And then, man, we had a 30-year treasury auction this week that was just god-awful. And at the same time, you've had the Moody's rating agency just cut the U.S. AAA outlook rating from stable to negative. So now I kind of brought everyone up to speed on what you were talking about and some of the things that have transpired since that FOMC meeting. What's your take on partly that rating and the response to the U.S. The 30-year Treasury auction?
Yeah, well, I think with regard to the bond rating, listen, anybody who analyzes, and I've said this several times, anybody who sits there and analyzes the United States in isolation, which exactly what a bond rating agency does, they just look at that company or that nation, they look at its fundamentals in isolation and does an analysis. The only conclusion you can come to with regard to the United States is that it's in horrible shape and a disaster is going to happen. I mean, that's just kind of a given at this point. But the problem with that is that we don't live in an isolated world. We live in a global world, and it's a relative game. And so the idea that the U.S. Treasury is going to get downgraded and not going to be able to raise money, but all the other countries in the world are going to be able to, that's where the whole argument breaks down. The other thing is when I see a rating agency give a rating to the country under which that ratings agency operates, I kind of think of like a 10-year-old kid telling the dad he's not doing a very good job, right? So sure, the 10-year-old kid can have his opinion and can make it be known, and he can write a note and put it on the kitchen refrigerator that says, "Dad, you need to do better." But at the end of the day, the dad's the boss, right? So yeah, okay, I'll try to do a little bit better, but at the end of the day, the dad's going to do what he's not going to rely on everything the 10-year-old says. And so I kind of, when I think about these bond rating agencies, if a bond rating agency is, you know, giving a rating agent a rating to Egypt or to, I don't know, Honduras, it's a little bit different than giving it to the United States of America, which is the current sole superpower, right? And it's not to say that that can never change, but it is a little bit different. I mean, at the end of the day, the last time this happened, not the last time, but I think it was in 2011 or 12, when the Standard & Poor's downgraded the U.S. rating agency. What happened was Treasuries actually rallied on the downgrade. And a month later, the president of Standard & Poor's resigned to go spend more time with his family. Now, you might think that that was a total coincidence, and maybe that was a high point for him to go out on, but I would guess that there was a few phone calls behind the scenes where the dad took the son in the bedroom and said, "Listen, kid, you're welcome to keep sticking those notes on the refrigerator, but I'm still the man of the house," right? So, you know, again, I don't want people to think that I don't worry about these things, and I don't think that they're not, I think they're not important. They are important. And the U.S. is on a bad path, and I'm never going to deny that. But you have to kind of keep it in relation to what's going on in the rest of the world. And I just still think that despite all the problems, the U.S. is still the cleanest dirty shirt. And people don't like that argument either, but, you know, that's reality.
Yeah, you don't have to like it. Now, I never thought the state of the U.S. Fiscal balance sheet and in the U.S. bond market would give us such a deep look into what your family life is like. Now I know.
One
that there's.
Time, I'll have to find it. One time my son got mad at me. I don't remember what it was, and he drew a picture, and it was like a guy. This is unbelievable. It's like and he stuck it under my office door or something, and like I found it. But it was basically a picture of a guy like laying on the ground with his eyes X'd out, like he was dead. And it said, "Dad, that's you."
That's it sounds like something you would receive on Twitter.
Totally.
It also reminds me really quick too. The I don't know if you remember the Chappelle Show episode when they do the husband swap. And the one kid's acting all gangster, and he takes him into the car and leaves him in the middle of the ghetto. So yeah, so we're not quite in the ghetto yet, but you know what, yes, it's a narrative, but at the same time, like you're saying, the U.S. is not on a pretty path. But if we were going to look at it globally, like you're suggesting. And we're going to look at these things like businesses and I had capital, I had to place, and I'm looking at the U.S. for all the obvious reasons. It's probably the number one place I want to put capital. But if I was investing in a business, not only do I want to know the trajectory of that business, but I also want to know the leadership. And I think that's one of the areas that's very foggy. I think for both, you know, the U.S. citizens that were coming up on an election year, but also for the capital markets. Like, we know Biden's not making decisions. Who is making decisions? Janet Yellen, at her given age, is she making the best decisions as a Treasury secretary? That's you know, something that easily could be argued against. So when we're considering this as a capital markets business decision, does it get that bad that there's just no one even in the market? Is this why you're seeing money go into gold when real rates are as high as they are? Is this why we're seeing Bitcoin overperforming all year long? You know, where do you think, I mean, you work with a lot of international investors. We understand why the U.S. makes sense in a lot of cases, but is there really no other option?
Well, no. So this is actually a great week and a great event, this 30-year auction, to kind of make this point. So I think a lot of times, because most people who've been following me know that I'm very bullish on the dollar, and I think the dollar is going to go much higher. And I think sometimes people will confuse the U.S. Treasury going higher with the dollar going higher. I'm kind of agnostic as to which way U.S. Treasury bonds go. If we get into a massive deflationary event, I would expect Treasury bonds to go higher, but I don't know that they will. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if interest rates continue going higher for a number of structural issues and some of the issues that you're highlighting here, in which case that would drive the dollar higher, because as you get paid a higher yield to be in U.S. Treasuries, that sucks capital into the dollar in order to buy the, you know, because you get paid more to have it. It's important to understand the difference between the Treasury and the U.S. dollar. Again, to operate on the global stage as the world currently works. Now, again, you may think the world is changing. You might think it's different a year from now. You might think there'll be some alternative systems that people can move to in the future. But as of right now, to operate on the global stage, you need U.S. dollars. And so if holding some kind of a treasury bond or some kind of a treasury security or some kind of a U.S. security that you need dollars anyway to operate, and you get paid more to save it in dollars than you get paid to hold it in pesos or rubles or yen or yuan or whatever it is, then it just makes the decision really easy to hold it in U.S. securities. And to hold U.S. securities, you need dollars. So that pulls capital into the dollar. So this kind of goes back to the milkshake theories, the basis for the milkshake theory. In the very first interview that I ever gave where I kind of laid out this thesis, I said interest rates would be higher. Interest rates would be higher, and they would be higher in the U.S., and that would draw capital in. And I said it will cause a sovereign bond and currency crisis. The way you get a sovereign bond and currency crisis is the exact things that you're talking about, John. Happening in the U.S., but it also happens abroad. In other words, it's the rejection of sovereign financing. It's the rejection of sovereign bonds. And people start looking for other places to put their money other than in sovereign bonds. And as they do that, sovereign bond yields rise. Now, as the sovereign bond yield rises in the U.S., that sucks capital into the U.S. And the U.S. is better able to deal with a budget deficit because it can print the dollars it needs. But the rest of the world, which also has dollar debt, and we've talked about this several times, there's more dollar debt outside the United States than inside the United States, they don't have the ability to print to service that dollar debt that they have. And so as the dollar gets stronger and puts their economies under strain, their sovereign bonds become less attractive as well. And as rates rise in those sovereign markets, they can't print to meet their budgetary needs. They have to start printing their local currency. That makes their local currency fall, and that puts them into severe economic pain, and people reject their sovereign bonds as well. And that's how you get a sovereign crisis, where yields start to rise and as investors reject them. And so I think you will see that in the United States. I think we will probably get to a place, I don't think we're there yet, but we're probably getting close, where they start mandating banks buy treasuries, pension funds buy treasuries, 401ks hold a certain amount of treasuries. Now, I think there'll probably be a crisis that leads to that decision, to something like that. But to your point, people will start looking for other places to put their money. I think that's why I'm a very big gold bull long term. I think in the short term, gold probably falls, as it has been over the last couple of weeks. But I think people will start seeking out alternatives. And it's not that I don't think that a U.S. Treasury auction could ever fail. I don't think it will happen, but it can absolutely happen. But if it happens, the idea that the U.S. Treasury is not going to be able to fund itself, but these other countries will be able to fund themselves in that environment, to me, that's just not reality. That's like thinking that you can blow up the foundation of the house and the attic still functions perfectly well, or the second floor dysfunction. All of these other currencies, all these other economies are pyramided on top of the U.S. economy. That's just the way the system is designed. You don't have to like it, but it's important to understand it. And so if a U.S. Treasury auction fails, that sets off a domino effect that affects the whole world. So the idea that the rest of the world should be excited or happy if there's a U.S. Treasury bond default, or if there's a U.S. Treasury auction failure, I would think twice about that opinion.
All right, so got it. But the searching for something else... Let me start over here. So if I'm looking to invest capital and I'm outside the U.S., the U.S. dollar is a reserve currency. They need to hold dollars. They need it to operate on the global marketplace. One of the ways that they store dollars is in the bond market, by buying U.S. Treasury bonds. Now, we talked about this in a previous episode, where countries say, like China, there's a lot of debate about the charts that were going around that China was de-dollarizing, and it showed this very steep decline, whereas that chart was actually, to some extent, showing the net asset value of China's bond holdings. In there, perhaps there is some selling, but because a lot of the accumulation of that previously $3 trillion worth of bonds was at a time when treasuries were very expensive and yields were low, and now the opposite is true, where bonds are much lower in value and yields are higher, the value of bonds that they're holding has declined significantly. So that becomes a real issue. So in light of that, and even right now at say 5.5% on the 10-year, or I'm sorry, on the Fed funds, generally across most of the curve, from even short T-bills all the way out to 30-year, we're around the 4.5% to 5% range, sometimes higher, sometimes a little bit lower. But if I'm going to invest money in the U.S. and you're looking at just how bonds have performed the last 2 years, the potential that 5.5% or 5% is going to offset the potential loss in net asset value, is this one of the reasons why you think that gold is hanging tight, and maybe Bitcoin? Are people already looking for those alternatives?
I think to a certain extent, yes. And I think that's why gold held up pretty well all year despite real rates rising, I think. And not to mention, though, again, people like to analyze this from a U.S.-centric position, which makes sense because the U.S. is the dominant economy. But the other reason I think gold has held up is because there's a lot of demand for gold outside the United States, and they've been buying it like crazy. And the rest of the world has been buying gold like crazy, not because of the dollar, but because their own currencies are horrible. That's another thing where I think people get confused. They will say, you know, look, the central banks around the world are buying gold, and investors around the world are buying gold, and, you know, people in China and India, the imports are flowing east, they're buying gold. And then they will turn around and say that's because the U.S. dollar is on its last leg. No, it's because their local currencies have already fallen down, right? So it's important to understand. And I think that demand for gold outside the United States, because all the other currencies are already in the shape that they think the one day U.S. dollar will be, has made gold stay strong. But this is probably another opportunity to talk about. Remember, the whole milkshake theory is that, and again, this happens in stages, and there will be drawdowns along the way, and there will be terrifying moments. From the very beginning, I've said we will get into an environment, and in the years ahead, the U.S. dollar will go higher, gold will go higher with it, and U.S. equities will go to all-time highs. And the reason I've said U.S. equities will go to all-time highs, and I think they're going to go a lot higher than they are now, but that will also be characterized by terrible drawdowns along the way, is the wanting to get away from sovereign bonds, the rejection of sovereign bonds. So if you live in Brazil, or you live in, I don't know, New Zealand or India or Sri Lanka or wherever it is, and you don't want to hold a treasury bond anymore, but you still need to hold U.S. securities, and you want to keep your savings in U.S. dollars, you might buy U.S. equities again, because even if U.S. equities stay flat, let's say you buy, and I've used this example several times, but I just think it makes the point very well. You know, if you live abroad and you're saving in dollars, and so you buy Coca-Cola, well, you need dollars to buy Coca-Cola, so you have an account with U.S. dollars in it, and you buy Coca-Cola. And let's say Coca-Cola stays flat. Or let's say Coca-Cola goes down 5%. Well, Coca-Cola pays a 4 or 5% dividend. So at the end of the year, even though Coca-Cola fell 4 or 5%, you're about even. But then if your local currency fell 10 or 15% versus the dollar, you're still up 15% in real terms versus your local currency. And I think that phenomenon, people rejecting global sovereign bonds, not just U.S. treasuries, but all sovereign bonds, including U.S. treasuries, or at least wanting to get paid a higher interest rate to hold a sovereign bond, people will start looking for alternatives. Like you said, they'll look for things like, I don't know, Bitcoin. They'll look for things like gold. And I think they'll look for things like large cap U.S. equities. And I think that's why we will eventually have this milkshake. And this is even happening when we're not in an easy money environment. But as the world goes back to stimulus, QE, they start printing, I think that's how you get this phenomenon where maybe the central banks are the only ones buying sovereign bonds. Everybody else is rejecting them to the extent they can, and to the extent they're not legislatively required to buy them, where you start seeing people roll into U.S. equities. And I think that has largely happened over the last few years. If you look at the flows into U.S. equities over the last 3 or 4 years, they've been enormous, and they've dwarfed the rest of the world. And that's why, you know, the market is near its all-time high, despite all the problems.
Now, you have mentioned, well, let me get your update then perhaps on the outlook here. We're coming towards the end of the year. We have, you have mentioned, you know, gold performs well in various situations, but be prepared for drawdowns because it's one of the most liquid assets. Bitcoin tends to kind of be actively sold in crisis moments. And the animal spirits, something we've talked a lot about lately, is trying to front run monetary policy by assuming that there's going to be a crisis. And when that happens, there's going to be extreme accommodative policies, more QE, more money printing, whatever you want to call it. But before that happens, generally there's going to be a big drawdown because people are going to need to cover positions or make margin calls. And so they're going to sell everything that's not, you know, glued to the ground, and they're going to sell the most pristine stuff first. So do you think, given history, that we're in an extreme tightening cycle, we're seeing a lot more bankruptcies, we're seeing manufacturing slow down, we're seeing just even recently with the non-farm payroll report at the end of last week showing the first uptick in unemployment in a really long time, do you think we're headed towards, we're getting closer to a liquidation event, even if it's short-lived, prior to maybe that next rocket higher because of expectations how the Fed will respond?
Yeah, I think that's likely. Again, you know, I think equities are going to go a lot higher, but I think in the short term, well, in the very short term, maybe for the next, you know, couple of days or a couple of weeks, maybe it still kind of continues this bounce. But then I think that we are going to have more downside in equities. And to your point, I think, and people need to understand, the Fed is not just going to come out tomorrow morning and out of the blue decide to go back to QE. They will go back to QE, or they will go back to stimulus, or they will go back to easy monetary policy if they have to do it to save the system. But as of right now, they are purposefully trying to slow the economy. They're doing this on purpose. This is not some surprise. They've been telegraphing this for a long time. The market keeps trying to front run them pivoting. And as they front run the pivot, they give Powell the soft landing, right? And so it's kind of like playing chicken. Like the Fed and the market are playing chicken with each other. Who's going to blink first, right? And so, the point is if the market keeps going higher, the Fed doesn't need to cut. The Fed certainly doesn't need to go to QE if the market keeps going higher. But at some point, something will break. There will be a large drawdown in the risk assets. You know, employment will go higher. Something will break in the banking system. There'll be a credit event where spreads blow out. And in reaction to what the market is doing, the Fed will pivot. But the Fed is not just going to wake up tomorrow morning and pivot just out of the blue and undo everything they've done for the last 18 months. The other thing is that I think it's just as, and who knows, we can all make these predictions. Nobody really knows. But I think it's just as likely that the central banks overseas pivot prior to the Fed, right? And so, and when that happens, and as they pivot, whether it's Europe, Japan, China, or some of them are already, in easy monetary policies. But as they go into easy money policies, if the Fed has not yet done it, that's going to make the dollar go even higher. And as we all know, over the last 25 years, every time there's been a crisis, the dollar goes higher. Now, whether the dollar going higher causes the crisis, or if the dollar rises in reaction to the crisis, I don't know. We could probably debate that for 10 years. But the fact is it's 100% correlation, and I don't think it's different this time. So as you know, if we get an easing environment overseas prior to the Fed pivot, the dollar goes higher, then perhaps we get some kind of a liquidation event, and then the whole world goes back to easy monetary policy together. And in that environment, I would expect U.S. equities to go much, much higher.
Well, we won't get into what's going on in other markets in this conversation, and perhaps it'll be something we'll keep a closer eye on as the new year begins. But what would be nice to do before we wrap up this episode is kind of get an update on some of the things that you are actively trading. You've been vocal about, you know, being somewhat short gold. I would always tease you that was kind of a bias because you wanted to buy just before it took off, but you've made the point about there being a war premium. So give us an update on what's going on in gold, and also give us an update because recently you also, partly tongue in cheek, partly maybe for fun, and partly because you felt like there was an opportunity, made a short bet on Bitcoin as well.
Yeah, so I'd say the 3 to 4 tactical trades we've made in, let's call it, the last 6 weeks have been gold miners, Bitcoin, and oil. And so you're right. Back at the beginning of October, like, I thought that gold was setting up for a fantastic, at least a short term, if not a long term, buying opportunity, because I thought we were getting close to a point where we were going to get a complete washout. And the miners were going to have a complete washout. And I was actually getting ready, or at least preparing to pick some up there. And then we had the events in the Middle East, right? And Gold went from, let's call it 1810 or 1825 to $2,000 in a couple of weeks. And so a couple of weeks later, I think it was around October 18th or 19th, it was a Friday, and gold surged again. A lot of it was on, Middle East concerns, and the miners went up a lot that day. And so I started buying puts on the miners, and I said so publicly. I put it on Twitter. We talked about it here. And of course, everybody thought we were crazy. You know, we're going into war in the Middle East. You should be buying gold, not shorting it. And the point I made was not that gold is a bad thing. I'm a big fan of gold long term, but that typically when gold rushes higher on a war premium or some kind of Armageddon trade, you know, I've been doing this for 25 years and I always see gold rise when there's disturbance or geopolitical volatility. And I've never, ever seen it last that it didn't give away all those gains within the next couple months. And so while, you know, it was kind of peak FOMO, I felt, we started buying the gold miners. I think GDX was around 2850. It was between 2850 and 2929 where we were buying our puts. And we just said, you know, we think that's overdone. So we started buying puts. And now GDX is at 27. So it's down significantly. So those puts are in the money. We've sold about half of them and taken all our initial capital off the table. So now we get the rest to just to ride for free. Or gold has pulled back from 2000 to 1935. So it hasn't pulled back as much. It's pulled back a little bit. Part of the reason that we decided to play the short position through the miners rather than bullion itself is because there could be a reason to own bullion, right? If we do have further geopolitical problems, you know, bullion would make sense to rise. But I didn't necessarily think the miners should rise on a war premium. And so that thesis has played out pretty well. We've made good money on those puts, and we have the opportunity to make more. The other thing that we had been short oil for a while, we shorted oil around 90. But can you imagine going into war in the Middle East? You're both short both gold and oil. I got to tell you, that didn't feel too good for, there was a couple of days where that was a little touch and go, but we kind of stuck with it and it worked. We were short oil and we had puts on Exxon. Both of those paid off. The Exxon puts paid off better than the short oil, but actually oil now pulled back all the way to 75 a couple of days ago. And so we actually started buying oil. We think that's a good level to start building a long position. Even if it's just for a short-term trade, I don't know if we'll hold those for a long time, but we think we can get a bounce there. So that has done well. Around the same time, I think it was the day of the Fed meeting. Maybe it was the day before. I also thought that Bitcoin had a big surge higher, and we thought that Bitcoin would pull back and still kind of do. And so we bought puts on Bito, which is a stock that tracks Bitcoin. And we thought that would be a good way to limit the risk, but take a shot at it. And so we bought puts, and that has not done well. Bitcoin went higher, and that was only a 2-week trade. So that expires a week from today. As of right now, it doesn't look like those will pay off, but you know, Bitcoin is volatile. We got a week to go. And so we'll see how that does. But I do think to a certain extent this week, we saw the war premium come out of both gold and oil. And so if that continues, maybe we'll get back to that good buying opportunity that we were looking at in early October.
Sounds good. Appreciate that update. Some other updates that would be worthwhile hearing from you is, if people can't tell, you are on the road. You've been a rambling man, a traveling man the past week or so. Before we get an update on where you are now, can you give us an update on your experience at the New Orleans Investment Conference?
Yeah, you know, I like going to the New Orleans Investment Conference because I see a bunch of people I know, and it's just kind of a fun place to go for a couple of days. And I think I mentioned this on last week's episode, but if I didn't, I'll mention it again quickly, is I sat next to a guy, a very well-known guy, and he and I don't always get along. We've always gotten along in person, but we don't always see eye to eye. I guess that's probably the right way to say it. But I sat there and I had a conversation with him for over an hour, and it was one of the best conversations I've had in a long time. And so to me, that was just a reminder that we can all disagree, but we can all get along too. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with sitting there and talking to somebody. You don't always have to agree with everybody that you're friends with. You don't always have to agree with everybody to have a fun conversation. And in fact, you know, disagreeing with people is sometimes the fun part of a conversation. So I think anytime you have the opportunity to talk with people who don't see things exactly like you do, I think that's a good thing. And now this week I'm in Nassau, Bahamas. And the funny thing is, so I flew home from New Orleans to Puerto Rico. And then to fly, you know, Puerto Rico to Nassau is not very far. But for whatever reason, there's not a direct flight between Puerto Rico and Nassau. So I literally had to fly from Puerto Rico, literally right over Nassau. You could look out your plane window and see Nassau down below you, all the way to Miami, lay over in Miami for 2 hours, and then turn around and fly an hour back to Nassau. So what could be a 45-minute flight is like an eight-hour experience. So, but anyway, what's interesting here is I'm with a bunch of real estate investors. And I don't consider myself a real estate expert. I know a little bit about it, and you know, I don't feel like I'm a total novice. But you know, this is their primary business, and I was speaking. They asked me to come speak to them, and the reason is because a lot of these people have, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80% of their net worth in real estate, and with rates going higher, that's obviously a concern, and that's been a headwind for real estate. So they've all gotten together to talk about, you know, things that are going well, things that are going bad, you know, to kind of ask each other questions. What's working for you? What things should we consider? And it's kind of fun to talk to them because some of them are very bearish. Some of them are worried. Some of them are very excited because, yeah, interest rates, you know, do have a headwind for real estate. And they've got a couple of them have actually, they had a bunch of cash and they paid down their loan so that they have deleveraged. So if we get into some kind of a deleveraging event, they don't end up having to give the building back or the house back or whatever it is back to the bank. And they're actually excited if we get some kind of a correction in real estate, because then they become distressed buyers rather than distressed sellers. And then there's a couple other people. And John, you might appreciate this. He was saying, listen, you know, we're not in the same situation. There's a couple of people who feel like we're in the same situation as 2008. But then there's a couple other people who say, you know, the inventory is completely different than it was in 2008. Inventory is low, you know, and the buyers, you know, even though the prices have come down on the houses, their payment is still very low. So they're not in the, you know, and even though interest rates have gone up, the payment is still low. So even if their revenue comes down, their payment is so low from having the 3% mortgage or whatever it is, they're not as in danger of being forced out of the house. And so he's actually very bullish. He's not as bearish as everybody else. So there's always two sides to every story. But it's been kind of fun for me to sit here and listen to these guys talk about a topic that I know a little bit about, but they know a lot more than I do.
Yeah, real estate's a fun one. We'll have to maybe peel the layers back on that in a different conversation. I definitely think this is different than 2008 in a lot of ways. But the result could still be the same. But yeah, let's save that for another time. We can see you're losing daylight there in the Bahamas.
It's getting dark right outside.
Yeah, we appreciate you jumping in and chatting with us. This was a good update on a lot of things that have been going on the last 2 weeks. It's also been kind of a good reminder of, you know, where things can continue to go, how much crazier they can get. And as you often say, keep your head during times like these. Brent, we appreciate you joining us. If you want to catch up with him when he is at his home fort and locked in and getting death threats from his son, you can do that via Twitter at SantiagoAUFund. You can follow me at John Kutzmita. And you can follow the show both on Twitter and on YouTube with Milkshakes Pod. We're coming up here towards the end of season one. We did a little season zero teaser around this time last year. So technically, we've done a full year of full-length episodes. We're well over 100 videos since we started doing a lot of different types of content in between during the week. We hope to continue to do that. We hope to share with you some new ideas for everyone to get involved and participate behind the scenes with us a little bit more in 2024. So stay tuned for that. Brent, before we wrap up, any last words?
No.
Okay, excellent. We appreciate everyone joining us. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you guys all real soon. This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.